Hello.
Hey, is this Karen?
Yes, it is.
Hey, this is Jason Fraley at WTOP in D.C. How are you?
I'm great. My hometown.
Yeah, I was digging into that a little bit. I think my high school used to play yours, actually. You were Duval?
I was Duval, yeah.
I was Linganore. Anyway.
Yeah, and then I moved into D.C. when I was 20, maybe 21, and lived there and started all my work in the theater there.
That's so awesome. All right, well, then we will definitely be remiss if we don't go. We'll go into a little of that app, but let's talk the movie first, okay?
Okay.
Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we're here with the one and only Karen Allen, here to talk about her new movie, Year by the Sea. Karen, thanks so much for joining us. This is an honor.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to talk.
Awesome. Now, obviously, this is based on the New York Times bestseller. I guess before we dive in too much, because I just watched the movie. You've spent a lot of the last probably year living it. But giving our listeners a quick rundown premise here.
Yes, we've been, it's just opening now, but for the last year we've been going across the country to film festivals and showing the film. And the story is based on a true story, Joan Anderson's memoir. She wakes up at 55 and her children are grown and one of her sons has recently married and she reaches out to her husband about, you know, things that they might do in their future, but he's still very much locked into himself as a, you know, into his career and the direction he's moving in. And in fact, he's accepted a job in Kansas. They live on the East Coast. He's accepted a job in Kansas without even talking to her about it, which comes as a, you know, an unpleasant surprise to her.
Naturally.
Yeah, and she suddenly feels as though she feels lost. She feels as though she's come to the end of a certain part of her life, which had been raising her children and where her world sort of revolved around their needs and her husband's needs and the needs of, you know, looking after a home. And she looks into her own future and has no idea where she wants to go or what it is she has to offer. And she had been a published writer at a younger point in her life, and she put that on a back burner, thinking that she would get back to it. And 25 years has gone by, and she just doesn't, she feels as though she's lost her voice. She doesn't even know what she has to say anymore. So she makes a kind of impulsive decision to leave and not go to Kansas with her husband, and to go, they sell their house, and she decides she's going to go and live in a little shack on the coast of New England, up on the Cape in Massachusetts, and she's going to spend whatever time there she needs to get to know herself and to reflect on her life and see if she can find a way forward. And she gets there and she meets a woman who is a psychologist who was, actually she was Eric Erickson's wife, Joan Erickson,
right.
Both kind of very well known in that community. And the woman becomes a mentor for her, which really did happen in life. And they stayed friends until her death. And she meets a lot of other people and finds herself in a lot of circumstances in which she has to reach out and help people, and or when people kind of reach out and help her figure out a way to survive there and be independent. And it's a journey for her, and she comes through the journey knowing herself better and not wanting to end her marriage, but in fact wanting to renegotiate her marriage, wanting to get to know her husband again and allow him to get to know the part of her that she feels she'll be carrying into the future, which is more than, you know, the mother, and more than the, you know, the cook and the person
right.
who makes the beds, and, you know, more than that. She's kind of almost like willing to let go of that role and find a much more vital part of herself to move forward in life. It's a story about transitions and about, you know, how we navigate them.
how we're all unfinished like the shoreline and need to transcend ourselves constantly, I think is your line that she writes at the
yeah.
end. Yeah. Oh, that's it's great. No, and it's the whole movie to me is sort of like that the vision quest that you and Joan talk about, and how, you know, you say once a year the Navajos spend 24 hours in the wilderness, you know, that they're trying to find the truth emerging from the silence. The whole movie kind of feels like that. It's kind of a quiet movie that allows us to kind of reflect on that for our own lives. That's what I really dug about it.
I'm so glad.
When did you find the book? Were you reading it, or did you?
No, I didn't. I was not familiar with Joan's work. I was just at home in New York, and I was sent the script, and I read the script, and was very taken by her story, and I literally half an hour later went out to a bookstore, found Joan's first book, Year by the Sea, and brought it home and read that, and I just found her very unsparingly honest about herself, and you know, she just had a wonderful way of taking me through that journey. You know, scripts are so often they're just the bare bones of a story, and
right.
this book really fleshed that story out for me so much. And a few days later, I met with the director, Alexander Janko, and he and I had a wonderful conversation about the character and about life and I left there thinking, oh, please, I hope they ask me to do this film. I just hadn't been quite as excited about a film in a while. And maybe a week or so later, they asked me to do the film. And then a few days after that, I was sitting having lunch with Joan Anderson, and we spent about 4 hours together talking, and she telling me more and more and more about her story. And I was quite delighted to just dive into this particular story, because I think it's a rare, you know, it's a rare kind of film that we don't get to see very often. We don't really get to be with people of that age who are trying to still figure out their lives and move forward. So there's four people in the film that are over the age of 60.
Right.
And I think that's it's unusual. Every once in a while there'll be a film, you know, that's maybe in that world, but
right.
I thought it was a rare opportunity. And you know, we're finding in people's response, whether it's people in their 30s or 40s who see this film through, you know, the struggles of their own parents, or whether it's people in the baby boomer generation who are living it, there has been this incredible connection to the film. I mean, I've never been in a film where at the end of the film, people come up and throw their arms around me and thank me for making a film. I think in the way that Joan is searching for her voice, I feel like there's a whole generation of audience that are searching for where is our voice?
Right. Where's our movies about what we're going through right now? I'm with you. There needs to be more.
There's very little out there. And I think what's really amazes me is I think that the baby boomer audience, we grew up as moviegoers, you know, from the time we
right.
were little, you know, we look forward to going to the movies.
Right.
And while the younger generation that used to be the demographic, now they're watching everything on their little iPads and their on their iPhones to some extent.
Right.
And this baby boomer generation still loves to go to the movies. We still like to go and sit in theaters. So I think that there's a world of audience out there that really is looking for films that more deeply connect to their own worlds. So it feels really lovely to be part of a film that is doing that.
I agree entirely. There needs to be more movies like this that treat sort of that phase of life with the delicacy and grace and seriousness that, I mean, yeah, there's comic relief in the movie, but, you know, a lot of times you get movies about that baby boomer, you know, generation now that they either just play it for straight, you know, slapstick like The Bucket List or something, but there's not that serious thing like you guys are addressing here. So I think there need to be more movies and more roles like this.
Yeah, it's it's kind of a soulfulness. A soulfulness. It's because actually it's more with Joan, it's more of an inner journey. Like she really wants to change. She really wants to pull away these sort of layers that have restricted her and made her feel stuck in her life. And she wants to move towards, you know, it's that little moment in the film where he says, "You've changed. What's wrong with you? You've gone wild." And
right.
she says, "No, I think I'm just starting to find, you know, the part of myself, you know, that I might, you know, that part of herself that she really would like to be."
Right.
You know, it's like she has this feeling inside of her that there is the more joyful, free, open, embracing, receptive person. And she, through all of the stresses and strains of 25 or 35 years of worrying about everything under the sun that parents worry about, she's kind of lost that spark, you know? And she wants that spark back. She knows it's in there somewhere, and she's trying to, you know, lose all of those, you know, all the stuff that's getting in the way of her own, you know, happiness, really.
Yeah. How much of you is it, everything you're just saying, I'm wondering if that's partly what you're going through too. Like, how much of yourself is in that in terms of, you know, I think you had a son like in 1990, but that's been what, 27 years ago. So do you sort of relate to that, you know, what the character Joan in the movie, you know, sort of the empty nester trying to reinvent yourself?
Well, you know, Joan and my lives are different in the sense that I did not stay married. My husband and I separated when my son was just six. So through most of my raising of my son, I was a single parent because he also, through a lot of that, lived at quite a distance from us, his dad, although he was very much a hands-on dad in the ways in which he could be. But I also never really stopped exploring creative things in my life, even when
right.
I did take a back, you know, when I stepped back away from doing a lot of the travel necessary to do big feature films because I really wanted to be there raising my son, I created other things in my life that sort of I found very interesting and had always been interests of mine. And so I never really felt, I only have one child, which is a little easier than when you have two, three, four. But I never felt like I put my own creative life on a back burner. But what I very much did relate to is that when they move out, when my son moved out and was suddenly out in the world on his own, there is this abyss. There is this, you know, I think it's a universal thing. I think we all feel it. And I know I have both friends who are going through it and friends who are dreading it as it approaches and friends who have gone through it and somehow gotten to the other side of it. I think as much as people like to, you know, act as though they're going to be relieved when their children are finally out in the world, I think, you know, and there may be some relief, but, you know, there's also this terrible sense of what now? You know, what now? Your life is so revolved around the well-being of your children and of the household and all of the million little things that go along with that. And you can go very easily into an identity crisis when suddenly those things are removed. And you know, it's not, you never really stop being a parent, but it's, you stop being a parent on a daily basis. And we all then, you know, get thrust into, and I think it happens to men as well. Men often, you know, have stayed for the most part more engaged in the working world throughout the process. Not all, because we have men, you know, who are very involved in raising their children. But, you know, I think men maybe have it, maybe it happens in a delayed way. When they retire, or, you know, it happens in a, you know, it comes to them through, you know, their wife who is maybe really struggling with it. So, you know, it's a wonderful conversation. And we find at the end of the film, you know, people have so much to share about their, you know, there have been people who said to us at the end of the film, "Oh my God, I think you've saved our marriage," which, you know, that's a pretty big statement.
Great. Well, you know, and you know why I think that works is not, I mean, A, you treat the whole, you know, that whole, the whole movie's journey, the arc with such, you know, truth and honesty, but I think also it's because in the end there is that sliver of hope, and I like that about it, that it doesn't exactly go where you think it's going to go. You know, there you have all the, you kind of, well, we don't want to spoil it for the viewers, so how can I dance around it? But you know what I mean? You kind of tease with you and the fisherman that maybe there might be a thing. There's even some double meaning in the dialogue when you say, "Hey, can you take me out?" And you really mean take me out on the water, but it's, But I like how you kind of flip that again on the end, and you got, you and the husband, you know, you try to do make it work. So maybe that's why people come up to you at the end. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I loved doing that last scene with Michael Christopher because, you know, in the end, we worked and worked. And this, the film had a couple of different endings, and we didn't know exactly what we were going to do with it. But we ended up just deciding to, again, kind of play with identity. And, you know, when Michael Christopher's character Robin says, you know, I've gone into therapy and I've discovered I'm a very angry young man, angry old man.
Yeah, he catches himself.
and they end up sort of reintroducing themselves to each other.
Right.
I think that that's such a lovely thing. It's sort of like, okay, we are who we are. We're all these things. And yet, hello, I'm Joan.
You know? Right.
Hello, I'm Robin. It's like... I think we all maybe love that idea that we can start over. It's such a liberating thought that we aren't so mired in the baggage of the past and all the little minuscule things that have gone wrong. You know, here and there, the misunderstandings or the moments of, you know, in which, you know, people moved in different directions, that there is a way to, on some level, take a deep breath, set these things to the side to be dealt with or to be forgotten, and to just move forward with a sense of possibility.
Absolutely. You mentioned the director, Alexander Janko.
Yeah.
He was a famous composer, right? He did My Big Fat Greek Wedding and a bunch of movies, but this I believe is his directorial debut as a director. What was it sort of like watching his own maturation and learning curve in that regard? You know, watching him transition. I mean, sure, he's been around movies his whole life, but you know, watching that in real time and helping him, you know, craft that debut.
It was extraordinary, and he is just he's a very, very warm, thoughtful, just, you know, he was a wonderful first-time director to work with. He had his whole heart and soul into this film, and he was learning by the seat of his pants as he went. He had, you know, the five of us, the five main actors, were there just in complete support of him. And, you know, I think, and he would say this too, you know, he was a first-time director has so many things that they're juggling, and because they're doing them all for the first time, it's really a very steep learning curve. And I think that, you know, to have actors, Michael Christopher, Ezepeitha Merkins, you know, to Celia Emery, and Yannick Bazin, to have all of us, you know, who really were very clear and knew how to do our job. So he didn't really so much, he was there to help guide us, but he didn't so much, as sometimes you do as a director, really, really have to work, you know, very closely to help the actors develop these roles. We had a week of rehearsal, and he did this wonderful work with us on the script. And he and Laura Goodnow, our producer, they have fought for this film with everything in them, and it's been so wonderful to see it now, You know, I've worked on a lot of independent films that, you know, some who never have seen the light of day, and
right.
some that have had their little moment at a film festival, and, you know, and but then, you know, kind of fade into, you know, the ether. And, you know, they have not given up. They are just working, and want to bring this film to. They know that an audience is out there for this film, and they want to try to do everything they can to find it.
Awesome. Well, it is a sweet, honest, and like you said, kind of rare movie. So I invite our listeners to go check it out when it comes out. I think it comes out in D.C. maybe September 22nd.
I think
something like that.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, speaking of D.C., our listeners need to know this. We can't bury the lead. You grew up around here, right? You bounced around a little as a kid, but you went to high school at Duval, which when I saw that pop up, I said, oh, my God, my high school played them in the playoffs. We beat them in a hook and ladder.
We moved to Maryland when I was 10, and I went to Charles Carroll Junior High School and Duval High School, and then I moved to New York when I was 17, but I came back to D.C. when I was 21, and I went to Georgetown University, and I lived at DuPont Circle for a number of years, and
wow.
I started to work in the theater there. I worked with the Washington Theater Laboratory and
so
was involved with the Washington Project for the Arts, and then I lived over in Adams Morgan for a number of years.
No way.
Yeah.
Jumbo slice.
And, no, it was, I will always think of D.C. as my creative home, because it was, you know, I think, you know, as a young person, you can kind of feel that you want to work in the world, in the art world, but you're never quite sure what your medium is. And I was living in D.C. when I saw an extraordinary performance by an actor who was part of the Polish Theater Laboratory. And really, my whole life turned on that, and I began to work in the theater in D.C., and it was a really wonderful time, very creative time, 72, 73, 74, 75 in that era. And there was just a lot going on in D.C., a lot of the very beginnings of work in the art world and work in music. You know, there were great things. Emmylou Harris was there playing, and
yeah.
Mary Chapin Carpenter. And there were, you know, I don't know if some of these clubs and stuff are still there, but it was all, even as a kid, when I was young, we used to sneak, you know, we would tell our parents we were going over to each other's houses or something, and we'd come into D.C. to go to great, like, clubs to see bands. And so I had a real relationship to Washington growing up.
That's so great. Well, it is a really creative spot. And then I know from there you kind of went out to Lee Strasberg Institute in New York and all that stuff. But to connect it to our listeners, how do you go from all your I guess when you got bit by the bug here in D.C. to your debut in Animal House? That's what we all want to know.
Well, it was actually very serendipitous is what it was. I finally left New York in 76, in the summer, D.C. I left D.C. in the summer of 76 and moved to New York City with the idea of working in the theater. And I was studying at the Strasberg Institute and with Stella Adler, and I just wanted to get a stronger, more traditional background in the theater, because my training had been very from experimental theater companies. And I just walked through the lobby. I saw a 3x5 card on the wall. It said, feature film casting college age actors and actresses, send picture and resume to. And I just, you know, put a picture and resume and put it in the mail to the address, and I got a call, and they said, we'd love to meet you for this film. I walked over to the address. It was Universal Studios in New York City on Park Avenue. I went up. The casting director strode over to me, and she said, I know you're not in the union. I know you don't have an agent, but I want you to come in and meet John Landis because you're my girl.
God.
Now, I don't know how often that happens. It seems like one of those very rare things. But I didn't have the part instantly, but she had just seen my picture and resume, saw that I had this background in the theater, saw that I had a kind of look that she was looking for Katie. And I had to audition numerous times, and they flew me to Los Angeles, and I had to audition with Peter Riegert. But in the end, they asked me to do the role, and suddenly I was, you know, within a month, I was in Oregon shooting this film in Animal House, this role in Animal House, and I had no idea that the film world was even a possibility, because it was just a foreign world to me. I had never met anybody who worked on a film in my life. So, talk about seat of the pants. It was very much just learning as I went. And fortunately for me, so many of the actors on that film were also doing their first film. So, you know, we were all in the same boat for the most part and helped each other. And John Landis was just an awful lot of fun to work with. And it was, you know, kind of him. He had done a couple of, you know, little indie kind of films,
right.
But this was his first real big film.
Yeah.
We didn't know enough to be intimidated by the process. We just thought, this is fun, this is great.
Man, but see, that whoever that casting director that walked over to you, and Landis too, I mean, man, like all those, think of all the people that came out of that movie.
I know.
Kevin Bacon,
her name
Belushi.
Was D.D. Well.
Okay.
And the other casting director was Michael Chinich, and they were both, you know, they were young casting directors, and they wanted to kind of put together a cast that they, you know, thought would be unusual, so they did a beautiful job casting that film.
Memories of it really quick, the actual shooting of it, like, did you actually get to interact with Belushi and Tom Hulce, all those guys?
Well, I never was in a scene with Belushi, really,
right.
but I did watch him work a lot. And whenever, you know, I wasn't in a scene, I was often on the set watching, just because it was so much fun. Like, Katie doesn't go to the yoga party, but I was there, like, off screen, watching everybody have an awfully good time. And, you know, I got to watch John, just, you know, his spontaneity and his ability to just, you know, do the most outrageous, you know, thing that was, you know, available. You know, if you put something in his hand, you put a jar of peanut butter in his hand, he knew what to do with it.
Oh, that's
and,
so great.
It was great. I got to know all those guys. We still very often see each other, and sadly, Stephen First just passed away, and we've been all mourning his loss, who played Flounder.
Yeah.
He had become a dear friend to us over the years. But I see a lot of these guys, you know, quite frequently. It was a bond that has remained.
Absolutely. And such great memories for you, I'm sure. And all that frat house drinking helped you to drink all the boys under the table as Marion Ravenwood. Turning that shot glass upside down.
Although Katie really was the voice of reason in that film. She was the one.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever see her with a drink in her hand. But
Well, we got to. My listeners will kill me if we don't talk about Marion Ravenwood really quick. I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, that's the one we're all going to, 100 years from now, remember you from. What I loved about your character was it kind of flipped the old, you know, Humphrey Bogart Casablanca. Like, you're Rick Blaine running the saloon. I love that. But memories of.
Hold on one second.
Yeah,
I
sure.
know I have to go, don't I? I'm so sorry. I have another interview that's starting right now.
Oh, crap. Could you give me one quick soundbite on Raiders really quick? Just didn't you guys improv the scene where you're at with the wedding dress and the knife and the hanger?
Yes, we did. We didn't improv it while we were shooting it, but Paul Freeman and I was never quite happy with how that scene was going, and so we went in and we kind of created that scene with each other, and then we showed it to Steven, and he loved it. With the whole thing with me hiding the knife, pulling the knife, Paul starting to laugh, and you know, that was something that was kind of invented on the fly.
Oh, that's so great. Well, thanks for, I mean, all your movies from Scrooge to The Sandlot. I mean, we love them all. So
thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. Everybody, it's Year by the Sea. I think it comes out September 26th in D.C. Karen Allen, thank you so much. You've been more than generous.
Thanks. Okay.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.